children and my wife. I thank my lucky stars to be living here today. But the flag still stands for freedom, and they can't take that.
Welcome again to the Sharia Crime Stoppers Action Line. We are proud to be American. I'm particularly proud to say that we're going to have a guest with us who is a fellow North American. That would be Tom Quiggin. Tom Quiggin, we're going to talk about terrorism in Canada, the enemies within Canada, and the threat to America. But before that, let me say a good evening to Eliza Jane.
Hey, Mo, how are you doing tonight? We've got a fantastic guest tonight to warn people in America about what's going on in Canada and the dangers within. So I'm really thrilled to be able to have this conversation with Tom Quiggin tonight. How are you doing, Mo?
Doing great. Before we go into that, one just reference, those of you that listen to us during the week on the Tuesday webinars know that we've been focusing on the enemies within the church, and we've spoken specifically about the Jewish, evangelical, and Catholics who are concerned that parts of their or of their faith communities are moving left and leaving them behind, and in fact involved in interfaith. So we call those folks the Remnant Army, Jews, evangelicals, and Catholics. And we recognize that this weekend, tonight, and the weekend are a great time of celebration for our Remnant Army. We want to recognize that. We want to wish everyone a happy Passover and Easter. We recognize that some of the folks who would be with us tonight will be celebrating again. It happens that we have a Friday night show, and there's no way to change that. Just a reminder that everything we do tonight will be available on a podcast for later listening, so we hope to have continuity with our attendees. Just one last comment. We're talking about celebrating Passover and Easter. I don't think it's an exaggeration, but at the end of our conversation tonight, you might want to think carefully about what it will be like in 2021 when it's time for Passover and it's time for Easter, depending on how the elections in Canada this year, 2019 with Trudeau, and the election in 2020 with Donald Trump go. What will it be like to celebrate Passover and Easter in 2021? We'll just leave that hanging for now. Our guest is Tom Quiggin. Tom is a former military intelligence officer, a former intelligence contractor with the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, and a court-appointed expert on jihadist terrorism. So, by the way, just before I forget, I am going to mention that he does have a book. The title is exactly what we're talking about, The Danger of Political Islam to Canada, with a warning to America. Tom Quiggin, welcome. Join us and give us some background, if you would, please.
Good evening, Mo and Eliza Jane. Good to join you here on a good Friday evening. As Mo mentioned earlier, I have somewhat of an eclectic career. I initially joined the military and did a lot of anti-submarine warfare and search and rescue work with Sea King helicopters on the East Coast. Worked extensively with the U.S. Navy and U.S. Coast Guard in that capacity. And then the military decided I should become an intelligence officer. I got a master's degree and spent 10 years with the Canadian Armed Forces in an intelligence role, traveling to the world's exciting hotspots that everyone I'm sure loves to go to. Albania, Bosnia, Croatia, Serbia, Belarus, Eastern Russia, all the sort of fun-filled tourism spots that people keep trying to kill each other in. After that, I worked for a while for something called the Privy Council office here, which you would recognize as sort of a cabinet office. And I worked for the intelligence section there that serves directly the prime minister and the cabinet. And I worked for about 6 years with the Royal Canadian Mounted Police in the Integrated National Security Enforcement Team, which is a multi-jurisdictional, multidisciplinary unit that does work on national security, terrorism, and as well as doing some other unusual things like investigations into judges and politicians and the sort of more sensitive cases. The last 6 years, however, I've spent virtually all my time looking at the role of extremist Islam in Canada, and by that I mean Islamists, and by that I mean that part of Islam which is political. Those people who are Islamists are political Islamists. They want to take their version of Islam, their version of Sharia law, and force that upon everybody literally around the world. These people don't lack for ambition. But for the last 6 years, that's what I've been doing up here in Canada, working away on that, and of course working with a number of American colleagues who, shall we say, share common interests.
Well, again, let me just connect the dot there. When we say political Islam, well, of course, we're talking about Sharia, for example, which is the definition that political Islam would fit within. So again, we are Sharia crime stoppers, and so this topic is very, very appropriate. Tom, we wanted to kick off tonight with a reference to a recent article that was in the Global News and also reposted by Bare Naked Islam, and the title is Canadian Muslims Responsible for Hundreds of Terrorist-Related Deaths and Injuries Overseas, and yet Prime Minister Justin Trudeau welcomes back these jihadi traitors with open arms. That really shocks us to some degree. I'm just curious how the general population in Canada reacts to that combination. The article, just one more set of detail, the article actually identifies and catalogs examples of the 300 people who were killed or injured by Canadian Muslim terrorists in other countries. Pretty astounding situation. And I understand it right. Justin does want them back and is providing, he wants them back in Canada. And I'm just curious, how do most Canadians feel about that?
Yeah, most Canadians are a little shocked. We should say there's kind of like two things going on here. One is this article that just came out. It's a reasonably well-researched piece of work. The guy that's the actual journalist is Stuart Bell, who's been working on this kind of stuff like forever, and is regarded as one of the few credible authors in Canada if you want to know what's going on in terms of national security, intelligence, terrorism, etc. But it's a very narrow look at people with whom they can prove are actually killed in terrorist attacks overseas carried out by Canadians. What's missing in all of that, because we simply don't have the data, is the number of people killed overseas by Canadians who are serving in ISIS as well. So that number of 300 is accurate, but it should be seen at the low end. And that's everybody, not only just the folks we sent to ISIS, but folks that wound up in places like Algeria and elsewhere where they were involved in major terrorist attacks against, and in the Algerian case, against a major oil installation. So yeah, this has been kind of a bit of a shock for Canadians. I think we all kind of knew this was going on. We just didn't realize the extent and the range. So not just Algeria and ISIS, but I mean, there's been Canadians killed a bunch of people in Bulgaria in what was essentially an attack for Hezbollah. There's a Canadian suicide bomber went to Iraq who killed about, I think it was like 23 or 24 people in one shot, and as well as Somalia, Russia, Syria, and a few other places like that. And of course, the United States of America, where we haven't had any fatalities recently, but several Canadians have had a go at America recently. You're, of course, aware of the attack about Flint, Michigan. We talk about that later. There was a young gentleman from Mississauga, Canada, became radicalized, as he described, in a Muslim school in Mississauga. And he and his friends were going to try and set off an ammonium nitrate bomb in the New York subway system. So, yeah, and then there's also, people tend to forget, back in the year 2000, quite a few years ago, there was a fellow that was going to try and blow up LAX, and he was actually caught at the U.S. border with the bomb on his car on the way to the airport. So just in case you think it's all a one-way thing, we've had a few Americans come up here, like Jamaat al-Fukra was a Pakistani Islamist outfit in upstate New York. They were trying to build a bomb, and they wanted to blow up a theater in Toronto. They wanted to kill 5,000 Hindus. This particular group of Pakistani Muslims didn't like Hindus. So they were caught, fortunately, by a border guard who noticed some suspicious material and started an investigation. So, yeah, unfortunately, Canada has been tending to export terrorists, and a lot more lately. Now, you mentioned our Prime Minister, Mr. Trudeau, Justin Trudeau. A lot of Canadians, I think, were really taken aback and quite shocked when in the parliament itself, so this wasn't just like an ambush by a reporter somewhere, but he was actually speaking on the public record in the Parliament of Canada, and he was addressing the leader of the opposition, the Honorable Andrew Scheer, and he actually said that if anybody is opposing the return of ISIS fighters to Canada, it's because they're Islamophobic. And then, I mean, if that wasn't enough, he made another statement, and he said he thought the return of ISIS fighters to Canada would be an asset because they would be a, quote, powerful voice for de-radicalization, unquote. And, of course, a number of problems here. One is Canada doesn't actually have a national de-radicalization program, nor is there sort of a privately sponsored de-radicalization program here. And not only that, our public safety department, which is a lot like your Homeland Security Department, the Liberal government was supposed to put somebody in charge of the section that was supposed to do all that work more than 3 years ago. And here we are 3 years later, there is still nobody in charge of it. So, yeah, Canadians have been genuinely shocked by that particular series of statements from Mr. Trudeau, but also from a whole series of other things. We can get into that. He has done and said a lot of crazy things in the last few years, which are really calling his credentials as a Canadian into question.
But Tom,
and
if I could just throw something out real quick. Sorry, Mo.
That's okay.
There really isn't any de-radicalization that goes on. I mean, just using that word and saying that in terms of what Trudeau thinks he's going to do with these ISIS fighters in Canada is incredible to start with. There is no such thing as de-radicalization because it's not a radical Islam that is performing the jihad. What are your thoughts?
There's a whole bunch of thoughts come to mind. You hit kind of a hot button issue there. The first one is, why do we even have the concept of de-radicalization when it comes to the extremist part of Islam? So why don't we have a de-radicalization program for the Irish Republican Army or for the Ba'ath separatists or for the Khalistani terrorists or whatever? Why don't we have a de-radicalization program for drug dealers or rapists or people who commit murder on more than one occasion kind of a thing? And one of the reasons is that the world had become so politically correct by 212, 213, 214, we couldn't talk about extremist Islam without being accused of racism and this and that. But yet, the term de-radicalization became politically correct, but sort of indicated somebody who was really a good person, you know, but they'd been exposed to this bad ideology and become a bad person. And now if they were just exposed to the good ideology, we could sort of bring them back over to the good side. So that's kind of where that comes from. Here's the problem, though. As you mentioned, there have been very few successes around the world in de-radicalization programs. The country of Singapore has had some success, but they're a, shall we put it politely, they're kind of a one-party democracy with a very strong government, which has very strong will, and they had a large coordinated program that had both carrots and sticks. But outside of that, for instance, the country of France spent about 20 million euros on a de-radicalization program that collapsed with zero success. The Australians have had a fairly decent go at a de-radicalization program, and they proudly tout their one success. Here in Canada, we had one guy who was, you know, assessed by the de-radicalization folks, and they said he was really a good guy, and they're going to put him on the straight and narrow. They're going to do all this. His name was Aaron Driver, and he turned into our first domestic suicide bomber. So I guess you'd have to put that one in the fail column when your de-radicalization success turns around to become a suicide bomber.
Right.
So, yeah, here's without going into it too far, the concept of de-radicalization for radical Islam is based on ideology. In other words, the belief is that somebody goes from being quote-unquote normal to becoming violent, i.e. a bomb or a gun or a vehicle attack or something like that, because of their exposure to ideology. And the reality is that's just not true for the Islamists nor for any other terrorist group like the IRA, the Basques, or whoever. What causes someone to go from quote-unquote normal to a point where they say, you know, I think I'm going to kill a bunch of people with a bomb or a gun or a vehicle? It's actually the politics of identity. It is how they identify themselves against their fellow community members and how they view their role in a leadership role, et cetera, et cetera. So to use a really bad analogy, the idea that de-radicalization can work on extremist Islam is a lot like somebody having a heart attack, so you give them chemotherapy. And it's like, well, chemotherapy is known to work, but it's a cancer treatment, not a heart treatment. So I would argue that the whole idea of de-radicalization was kind of flawed to start with. And unless it seriously takes a look at the actual reasons people become violent, it will continue to fail, unfortunately.
I guess I did hit a hot button.
You sure did. I think you did. And a good one. So let's just imagine, I don't know, we're going to let you educate us on the conservative side, the people running against Trudeau, if you would. But in my mind, if we had Donald Trump, as if he was the opposition in Canada, he might be so bold as to actually take this particular issue where Mr. Trudeau is jeopardizing the safety of the Canadians by allowing these murderers to come back in with some kind of a flimsy rehabilitation program. I'm curious, is the opposition in Canada jumping on this issue? Is there a strong opposition? And maybe you could just give us some feeling for, is this even an issue right now, let's say in the campaign coming to head in November?
Yeah, let me just sort of put it this way. There is no strong, coherent opposition to the return of ISIS fighters or to the larger issue of how extremist Islam is being allowed to spread in Canada. There have been a few spasmodic statements and a few people saying, and including some members of the opposition, saying, hey, Canadian law is actually written in such a way that if you leave Canada with the intent of joining or working for a foreign terrorist group, when you return, you are guilty of just that, working for a foreign terrorist group. Even if you go over and dug ditches or you peeled carrots in a kitchen, but you were working to support that terrorist group, then you are by definition guilty of a criminal offense. But what the government's been doing, the government of Mr. Trudeau and our Homeland Security guy, our public safety guy, Mr. Goodale, has been saying, well, you know, oh, it's too difficult. We can't prove they actually committed crimes in ISIS. You know, we don't have witnesses. We don't have a cooperating police force over there. And it's really, really hard to get battlefield evidence. And he's true. He's correct in a sense. I mean, I worked for the War Crimes Tribunal for a while, and I know how hard it is to get battlefield evidence. But the simple reality is leaving the country to join a listed terrorist group and coming back is a crime itself. So of the 90 or so ISIS fighters we have walking around in Canada, so far I think they've charged two of them criminally and they have one guy up on a peace order kind of thing. So the government's response has been quite weak. And the opposition, has kind of mumbled a few times, but has never taken a really strong stand on it. And the reason is they're afraid if they take a strong stand, they'll immediately be labeled by the press as racist or Islamophobic or, you know, blah, blah, blah. So that's kind of the situation where it's at. The Conservative Party itself, a lot of people had assumed, perhaps incorrectly, that the Conservative Party would be, maybe to use another medical term, inoculated against having entryists, having radical Islamists move into the party, which we've seen like in your Democratic Party, for instance, with Valerie Jarrett in the White House and Huma Abedin, who works for Hillary Clinton. Both her parents are like literally Muslim Brotherhood, like I'll call them royalty, like they're very senior members of the Muslim Brotherhood. And then you've got a couple of Congress critters right now running around who have dubious backgrounds. So we've seen that kind of thing in the Liberal Party up here and the New Democratic Party up here. But now we're actually seeing the same thing happening in the Conservative Party. And I think come August and September in the run-up to the federal election, we're going to see the Conservative Party get called out and they're going to be asked, you know, make a stand on this issue, yes or no. So I don't know. The election's coming. We'll see what happens. I'm not overly confident at the moment, though.
So it sounds like you have your own people sitting in Parliament who would be the equivalent of Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib. Is that correct? Whether they're women or in hijabs. But I mean, you have basically Muslim Brotherhood type people in the Parliament. Is that a fair statement?
We have a number of people sitting in our Parliament who have overt sympathies to the Islamist cause. Yes. Ikra Khalid is probably perhaps the one that's best known up here just because of her profile, much the same as Ilhan Omar is in America right now. And she was the parliamentary sponsor of what's called the M103 anti-Islamophobia motion. And on the surface, it was just a motion in Parliament, which would decry, you know, sort of racism or extremism against Jews, Black, gays, and Muslims. But it's titled M103 Anti-Islamophobia. It will not define what Islamophobia is, and it clearly designed much along the same lines as the Pakistani blasphemy laws. In other words, you can't criticize anything to do with Islam without falling afoul of the government. And initially people said, well, you know, why are you even worried? It's just a motion in Parliament. It's not an act of Parliament or anything like that. But sure enough, we've since seen they then had an inquiry and then they've allocated $20 million to studying more Islamophobia in Canada. And it's very clear that we're going down the path to where it's okay to criticize Jews. It's okay to criticize Christians. It's okay to criticize Hindus or, you know, anything else, Taoist, Buddhist, whatever, but you're not allowed to criticize Muslims. And people are sort of saying, why is it that Muslims require special protection under the law, especially when here in Canada, the folks who suffer the worst from hate crimes, and I mean actual hate crimes, not the, you know, somebody said something mean to me hate crime, but actual hate crimes where people get beaten or shot or fired out of their jobs and that kind of thing. Here in Canada, it's gays, Jews, and Blacks that always are 1, 2, and 3 in the statistics, and Muslims are always a distant fourth. But yet they claim they require special protection. And of course, the answer to the question is, why do we have the whole concept of Islamophobia? It is to silence anybody who criticizes political Islam, anybody who criticizes the Islamists. That's the people that are pushing it. And the reason they require Islamophobia as a concept is because their ideology, their identity, their belief system, that which they support, is so absolutely contrary to the American Constitution. It is so contrary to the Canadian Constitution. It is so contrary to our shared value systems that they would just never be allowed to fly, period. So rather than adjust their views or integrate or you know, accommodate into the system, they've instead chosen to say, we will force you to not criticize us so we can grow our system here. So yeah, it's a real problem. You're seeing it now, and I think you're going to see a lot more of it in America now that there's under President Obama, I think groups like CARE USA and ISNA and ICNA, et cetera, were able to gain a lot of momentum, a lot of strength. Folks in the Democratic Party like Keith Ellison, who is now the, I think he's the Attorney General of Minnesota, whatever he is, He's a real guy to watch. He's one of the worst. Yeah, he's one of the worst of American Islamists. And now he's in a position of actual influence. And like you mentioned, you've got a couple of Congress people who've now got a foot in the door. And just by way of observation, they use the same playing system there that they use here. They will go out and say the most outrageous things. They will do the most outrageous things. And then when you criticize them, they claim they're the victims. So no matter what happens with the Islamists, they immediately claim victimhood. So right now, for instance, we're seeing, you know, with the returning ISIS fighters, now we're starting to get the, well, you have to understand the ISIS fighters are the victims here because they were forced to leave Canada and America and the United Kingdom because of the terrible Islamophobia against them. That's why they went to ISIS, which, of course, is absolute nonsense. Muslims here are never at the top of the hate crimes list. We have, I think, 11 different Muslims sitting in parliament. We have Muslim mayors. In fact, you know, there is no overt discrimination against Muslims in Canada, but still they will play the victim card. So, for instance, Ilhan Omar, the female Congress person there, one of the first things she did when she was elected to Congress is she went and did a fundraiser for CARE, the Council on American Islamic Relations, CARE USA. And CARE USA, C-A-I-R, that one, not C-A-R-E, but the Council on American Islamic Relations, is an actual listed terrorist group in the Middle East. So if you were a member of CARE USA and you tried to land in the United Arab Emirates, you'd be arrested as a terrorist. Whereas in America, they're not a listed terrorist group. But she went to do fundraising for a listed terrorist group in the Middle East. So, I mean, even a Sunni Arab Muslim state says that CARE USA is a front for terrorism. It's a front for the Muslim Brotherhood. So she goes to do a fundraiser for them. And then when people complain, she goes, oh, people are Islamophobic and now I'm getting death threats. And it's like, darling, you know, if you do a fundraiser for a terrorist group, you are entering the world of political violence. You are supporting a group which supports political violence. And in my world, if you want to do that, I say to you, fine, but do not express discontent or anger when people then complain about it. So that will be the playing card. That will be the thing they will use for the next couple of years. Every time they go to do something like make an outrageous statement or go do a fundraiser, like her statement about 9/11, where she goes, well, you know, some people did something. That's done deliberately to provoke people so she can then claim victimhood.
Tom, do you hear as much in Canada like we do here in the U.S., where we're trying to get the Muslim Brotherhood designated a foreign terrorist organization? Are Canadians as concerned and doing anything to identify the Muslim Brotherhood as a terrorist organization for Canada?
The current government is not, that I'm aware of. They have done virtually nothing in that department or that area. The previous government under Stephen Harper didn't take real strong action, but they did take some action. So, for instance, we had a federally registered charity up here called IRFAN, the International Relief Fund for the Afflicted and Needy. The government of the day had the our CRA, our tax department, our equivalent to your IRS, did an investigation into them and said, yeah, we've repeatedly warned this group that it looks like they're funding Hamas, which is a listed terrorist group here in Canada, and that's illegal and they should stop it. So they didn't. So the government eventually pulled their charity status so they couldn't issue tax receipts anymore. And then, much to everyone's surprise, they just kept right on going. So the government actually listed them as a terrorist group here in Canada. So merely belonging to the organization now or giving it $1 constitutes a terrorist act. So that finally stopped it. The interesting thing with IRFAN, of course, is it was putting all of its money overseas into Hamas, which we list as a terrorist group here in Canada, as do you folks. But Hamas is the Muslim Brotherhood in the Palestinian territories, and that's actually written in the charter of Hamas. They three different times in their own charter, they claim their brotherhood. So, yeah, we have had some steps against some groups here in Canada. The government, the last government, also pulled charitable status for something called the Islamic Society of North America, Canada. And you have an Islamic Society of North America, USA, and Indiana, and throughout America. But the Canadian arm up here was caught funding a terrorist group in the Kashmir region. And this is essentially traces back to their Jama-e-Islamiyah roots, which is sort of like the Muslim Brotherhood in South Asia. So the government popped them and took away their charitable status for doing that. So there has been some activity. The last government was actually toying with the idea of either listing the Muslim Brotherhood as a terrorist entity or listing a certain part of it, like perhaps the Egyptian Brotherhood as a terrorist group. But we had the election, that plan fell apart, and to the best of my knowledge, there is no plan in place right now in Canada to do that.
So, Tom, one observation, listening to the way the cards are played, the games, the victimhood, we can see a dramatic overlay between Canada and America. The Muslim Brotherhood thinks of North America as a single entity. The explanatory memorandum was a single plan for North America. So it makes sense that we would see the Muslim Brotherhood behaving in Canada in the same way that it behaves in the United States. And, of course, we typically think of the Muslim Brotherhood as terrorists in business suits because their primary objective or their primary tool is civilization jihad, where they become members of parliament or members of Congress. However, we believe they'll do the civilization jihad until they need to do the kinetic jihad. And the kinetic jihad is really what we want to go back to. So we have this situation where Canada has, based on statistics, become a breeding ground for people who, whether they started as Canadians or they came into Canada. And of course, Canada has now signed the UN Migrant Compact. So the expectation is, no matter what you've got going on Canada today, in 3 years, you will have another 350,000 migrants from around the world, many of them Sharia compliant people like the ones we've been talking about, who will be entering Canada on top of this. But the notion here is that there is a breeding ground. There are people committed to mass murder called jihad. They could be doing it for identity, as you indicated. They could be doing it to conversion to Islam with the commitment to the Sharia sanctioned activities, which include mass murder. So now we're going to go back to the story, and we would like to just focus on one pretty close to home story, and that's the story that emanated. In fact, I read in the paper today, the gentleman who was from Canada, was originally from Tunisia, lived in Canada for a number of years, maybe eight, had a professional occupation, was obviously college credentials, came into America, spent a weekend in America, frankly, in Southeast Michigan, just over the Canadian border, went to a gun show, attempted to buy a gun, was not able to buy a gun because he wasn't a citizen. He was rejected. There was some kind of, we know people who were at that gun show, believe it or not. It was really close to parts of Michigan where some of us have lived. And there was a kerfuffle about his inability to buy a gun, and he reluctantly bought a knife. We know that. He then proceeded to be in that territory, actually in the Macomb County area, up to Flint, Michigan, into the airport. Within the next day, he put a knife into the throat of a police officer who was doing security in the airport. We're looking at a terrible picture right now. It's actually maybe displaying on the online version of Global Patriot Radio. Lieutenant Jeff Neville, an American police officer, we're looking at his neck, and it is sliced almost all the way through. He did not die, but obviously this was an attempted beheading by a Canadian terrorist in America. The significance of this is he did spend at least 24 hours, maybe longer, in the communities around this area. We have people who live there. They had meetings. They had Tea Party meetings during this time. He could have decided to go after any one of those people, perhaps people that we would know, perhaps people who would be on this phone call. What's interesting is the court case was decided today. He was given life imprisonment in a court. And he showed absolutely no remorse. His comments were, he only wished he could have bought a gun, maybe even a submachine gun, and he would have killed as many Americans as possible. There's some backstory that he was an immigrant to Canada. He didn't feel comfortable in Canada, and somehow or other, he was motivated to come to America and kill as many Americans as possible. Fortunately, there was one very seriously injured policeman, and that was the extent of it. But that's the point of this part of our conversation. the border is basically open, and we have people like this gentleman who can come in and kill Americans. And obviously, the statistics show there's plenty of Canadian terrorists emanating from Canada, whether they went away and came back or not. They're sitting up there on the American border.
Yeah, it's getting to be an actual problem. And that, as you mentioned earlier, the book I wrote, The Danger of Political Islam to Canada with a Warning to America, I mean, that subtitle is there for a reason. And the podcast series we do, The Quiggin Report, also focuses on this on a number of occasions, looking at the, you know, the cross-border implications of what's going on here. And yeah, just a quick little backstory here. When you all had President Obama in the U.S., we had Prime Minister Harper up here, and they were, shall we say, diametrically opposed in a number of issues, including this one. So, I mean, under President Obama, you actually had senior members of the Muslim Brotherhood from Egypt allowed into your U.S. State Department to do interviews and discussions there. And I might add that was organized by a Canadian, by the way. And then you also had people like Valerie Jarrett in the White House, who was identified as, yep, you know, President Obama's chief of staff, they used to call her. And she had incredible sympathies towards the Iranian Islamists and others. And then if you look over at the Clinton administration, or the Clinton, when Mrs. Clinton was the Secretary of State, they were heavily involved in a number of very good deals for the Muslim Brotherhood in places like Egypt and Libya. So there was Obama kind of pushing that down there while the Canadian Prime Minister was resisting it. And now we've had this bizarre flip where we have President Trump, who appears to be taking some fairly hard lines on immigration and a number of issues. But we have Prime Minister Trudeau now, who welcomes the return of ISIS fighters. He has opened the Canadian border where people can literally just walk across now from America at any time they want, walk in anywhere and declare refugee status. Very little checking done, that sort of stuff. He has a consistent 11-year history of supporting the Islamist cause at every occasion, with actually only one exception. And we're sort of looking at it, and we try and remind Canadians, and we say, look, the absolute nightmare scenario for Canada for a terrorist attack is not that somebody blows up the CN Tower in Toronto, or somebody you know, shoots up a baseball stadium in Toronto, or a hockey game in Montreal or something. That's a bad scenario. The nightmare scenario for Canada is if a Canadian, someone like Ahmed Rassam, goes across the border into America and blows up the Statue of Liberty, or blows up a subway station in New York, or blows up a bunch of Red Wing fans in Detroit or something like that. Because the response from America, I think this time, will be very hardcore. It'll be very strong, and it'll be very rapid. And typically in the past, when there's been screw-ups between Canada and the United States, we've always been able to fall back on the legitimate excuse that, hey, we might have failed, but at least we were trying hard, and we need to cooperate more on intelligence and that sort of stuff. But this time, if there is a successful attack of a major type, yeah, I think the Canadian government's in trouble. Now, interestingly enough, folks from your embassy up here, that is to say the American embassy here in Canada, approached me after I published this book and wanted to talk more about the details and background. But it was interesting. They said the number one job of the U.S. embassy in Canada is to keep the Canadian-American border thin. And by that, they mean the ability of heavy logistics vehicles, electrical lines, pipelines, and all that stuff to go back and forth and cross the border with very little security, because that's good for everybody. We are your largest single supplier of oil. We are your largest trade partner in North America. We are your largest trade partner, period, except for China. And of course, in return, you are our largest trade partner on virtually everything. So an open border is profitable for all concerned. However, if Mr. Trump wakes up one morning and decides to close the border because he's angry about a terrorist attack, then as we say here in Canada, you'll catch a cold, but we're going to die from the flu. So yeah, it's very important. A number of people in Canada and the police and the intelligence services are increasingly worried, not about ISIS or Al-Qaeda or Al-Nusra. They're increasingly worried about the role of the Canadian government, saying we at least have to look like we're trying to be hard on these issues, not like we're being literally rolled over. And when our own prime minister says, you know, we should have ISIS fighters return to Canada, it just kind of like, you know, blows all that right out of the water.
Tom,
well, you presented an interesting.
I was reading. I apologize, Mo. There's an article I was reading last November stating that Canada's Justin Trudeau, the great reformer of Islam. You mentioned him and the linkages he's got with so many of the Islamists and how they're bringing them back and the ISIS fighters and all of this. And one of the statements in this article, I'd like your comment on it, says Trudeau is perceived as a reformer of Islam, who in the guise of displaying a clear affection for Islam is attempting to inculcate, or in my words, indoctrinate the younger generation with liberalism. And I think he's talking about Muslim younger generation. He seeks to create over the years a Muslim community that will adopt liberal values and distance itself from the religious leadership in a process similar to that experienced by other immigrant communities. Justin Trudeau, a reformer of Islam. Do you think he really believes he can do any reformation of Islam? You think that's his motive behind him opening up the doors to this?
I think that's the excuse he's been given, and it's demonstrably false. And here's why I would say that. We have a whole bunch of different kinds of Muslims in Canada, just like you do in America, Sweden, Norway, Germany, Belgium,
right.
Everywhere. We have a rather discouragingly large crowd of Islamists, which is to say, you know, the Islamic Society of North America, the Muslim Student Association, the Palestine Committee, IRFAN, Benevolence International, a bunch of these groups. Hardcore political Islamists who support caliphate, who support Sharia. Then, on the other side, we've got a whole bunch of other Muslims who are modernist, humanist, democratic, and they say, look, Islam has to move ahead. It's got to weld onto itself human rights. It has to weld on democracy. It has to weld on some sort of modernization in order to move forward into the future, like many other great faiths have done in the past. They realize they kind of have to move with the times a bit.
A reformation, right? You're talking reformation,
That's a reformation.
Right?
Here's the problem. The only people Trudeau meets with, the only people he's ever photographed with, the only people he gives money to, are always on the Islamist side. He will not work with the Muslim reform movement. He will not work with Muslims Facing Tomorrow. He will not work with the Canadian Thinkers Forum. He will not work with any of those people. He won't even take a phone call from them, let alone show up at one of their meetings or invite them into the parliament or something like that. So, well, he likes to say, oh, well, you know, Islam is completely compatible with Canadian values. The reality is he's meeting, for instance, with ICNA, the Islamic Circle of North America. And they put right in their own teachings on their own website. And, yeah, I mean, you have to love them. They're open about this stuff. They actually came out after Trudeau said that and said Islam is completely incompatible with democracy. So, you know, give them that. They're honest anyway. So, yeah, the only people Trudeau meets with are like the ISNA, the ICNA. He's met with folks from the Muslim Student Association. He's met with folks from the Muslim Association of Canada. But he won't meet with any of the moderate groups. And he absolutely refuses to deal with anybody from the ex-Muslim groups that we have here in Canada. We have a number of sort of support groups and political lobby groups, which are ex-Muslims, who are literally saying, hey, I left Pakistan or I left Saudi Arabia, I left Algeria or wherever because of this stupidity. I come to Canada and now I'm being told I have to deal with it again. So the ex-Muslims are really outspoken. They say, you know, wake up, people, see the warning. But Trudeau won't deal with them at all.
Well, Tom, let's put a point on that. If there is, God forbid, an attack in America from Canada, Canadian terrorists, and you mentioned that somebody like the response could be harsh, particularly if you could go back and look at the facilitation of the of these jihadists. So let's talk about this. Recently, you've come out with a claim that demonstrates that terrorist organizations are being funded by taxpayer dollars funneled through Trudeau's government agencies, in particular, in conjunction with a particular group called Islamic Relief Canada. Can you tell us about the work you've done, how you presented that, and what's really involved in this this complaint that you're involved in?
Okay, so first, just a very little quick bit of background. I used to work for the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, as we mentioned, and I was a contract intelligence analyst who worked specifically on terrorism problems, and I actually testified in criminal court on these kinds of cases, which is how I got to be a court expert the first time. So what I did last October was myself and a number of other folks, Tahir Gora and Rahil Reza, and Benjamin Dietcher and a couple of others, Joe Hazelton, were involved. Or no, Joe didn't sign it. But anyway, a bunch of us put a complaint into the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. And we said, look, Canadian law is quite clear. If you send money down a path which you know may wind up in the hands of a terrorist group, that constitutes a criminal offense, which is like the same sort of law you have in America. We also have an adjacent law to that that says, if you go out of your way to support an organization which supports terrorism, advocates for it, whatever, that itself constitutes a criminal act. So we said, look, here's what we see happening. There is Government of Canada money, that is to say taxpayers' money, is being given to Islamic Relief Canada. Islamic Relief Canada is a federally registered charity, so they have to keep proper books, they have to make financial statements, et cetera, et cetera. In their own financial statements, they say Islamic Relief Canada sends millions of dollars out of the country, and it's millions upon millions of dollars out of the country to go to Islamic Relief worldwide. So we said, look, you know, nothing there. That it is what it is. But, and we said, here's the problem. Islamic Relief Worldwide has been stated by a number of competent authorities and observers to be involved in the business of funding Hamas and a bunch of front groups who operate around Hamas. So you ask the question, well, if you're going to say that Islamic Relief Worldwide is funding terrorism, and this is a British-based outfit, you know, you might want to have some actual evidence for that. Like, so what am I basing it on? So what am I basing it on? First off is the government of the United Arab Emirates says that Islamic Relief Worldwide is a terrorist front, a funding organization. It's part of the Muslim Brotherhood. So there you go. The government of Israel says that Islamic Relief Worldwide in their activities is funding terrorism in their region. So here you have a Sunni Arab Gulf state agreeing with Israel, which by itself is kind of weird, but anyway. But they both agree that Islamic Relief Worldwide is a terrorism funding threat. Then you've got the government of Bangladesh, which is kind of a hardcore Sunni Muslim government, and they're really strict there. But they have banned Islamic Relief Worldwide from operating in Bangladesh or the camps because they say Islamic Relief Worldwide constitutes an extremism threat. Then you've got HSBC Bank, which is one of the world's top 10 banks in terms of sheer size, a British-based outfit. And they closed all of their accounts with Islamic Relief Worldwide, citing security and terrorism concerns. And then you've got UBS Bank, which very few people have heard of, but it's one of those quiet little Swiss banks that's worth umpteen billions. And they did the same thing. They cut off Islamic Relief Worldwide and said they wouldn't do any inter-country transfers for them, funding concerns. And then you've got the Charities Foundation in the United Kingdom, which oversees the validity of British charities. And they said they would no longer work with Islamic Relief Worldwide or put their name on the most favored list. And it's interesting, even they came out and said, look, we have 4,000 charities in the United Kingdom that are Muslim or Islamic in orientation. And we're saying one is bad. And that was Islamic Relief Worldwide. So it's not an Islamophobia thing or an anti-Islamophobia thing. I mean, it's just like out of 4,000 charities, they say they've got one bad one and that's it. And then here in Canada, we had the Financial Times did the same thing. They used to have Islamic Relief as one of their top 25 charities, and then they pulled it off the list citing terrorism concerns. So what our complaint to the RCMP was, like, hey, look, Canadian taxpayers' dollars is going from the government to Islamic Relief Canada. From Islamic Relief Canada, it goes to Islamic Relief Worldwide. At that point there, when it hits Islamic Relief Worldwide, the government of Canada, and we specifically named Prime Minister Trudeau and a couple of other ministers, they have to realize that at that point, as the money goes from Islamic Relief Worldwide downwards, that some of that money is definitely winding up in the hands of Hamas, which, of course, is a listed terrorist group. The RCMP, to their credit, responded in about 3 hours and said, yep, we got your file. but no comment on it, nor did I expect anything that quickly. And then about 3 weeks later, they sent me another email that said, we've got your file. It's been reviewed by the appropriate people in the commissioner's office, and the commissioner is like the big boss of the RCMP, that it would be assigned a file number, and it would go for, as they described it, appropriate action, i.e. investigation, because that's what the RCMP does. So there is an actual file number on it, and the RCMP apparently is taking some sort of action, but obviously they won't speak about an ongoing investigation because that's the nature of the Federal Police Department. But now, what's happened since then, of course, is we've been sued by Islamic Relief Canada, who they claim, Islamic Relief Canada is claiming, that by saying Islamic Relief Worldwide is funding terrorism, that we are inferring they're an Islamist group and we're inferring that they support terrorism, et cetera, et cetera. And so this is going to be a... We're deliberately intending to take this to trial. We're not going to plead it out. We're not going to walk away from it. We want to take this to trial because we want to be able to show that Islamic Relief Worldwide is, in fact, doing what we say it's doing. And interesting enough, the German government came out last week and said that they think Islamic Relief Germany has major ties to the Muslim Brotherhood as well. So, and in America, your FBI won't answer questions, but I know somebody in the United States did a, what do you call it down there, the Freedom of Access to Information or whatever your call law is called down there, an access
right.
to information request. Freedom of Information Act, yeah. So they were refused and they were told they couldn't have any information on Islamic Relief USA due to the ongoing investigation. So it's like, oh, the FBI has an investigation ongoing in America as well. So there's a number of countries that are starting to look at Islamic Relief Worldwide as a potential problem. But nonetheless, Islamic Relief has a right under the law to sue us for libel, which is what they're doing. And we are going to defend this on two basic grounds. One is truth. In other words, everything we put in that complaint to the RCMP was in fact true. And just so you'll know, my other area of court expertise in the federal court was the collection of intelligence as evidence. In other words, I have taught courses to our Justice Department here. I taught a course to your Guantanamo Bay legal folks in Washington, the use of intelligence as evidence. And I've testified in federal court as the use of intelligence on evidence. And everything I put in the complaint to the RCMP is a known, open, provable public fact. In other words, these are documents from the charities themselves, they're documents from the Government of Canada, documents from the United Arab Emirates, documents from the HSBC Bank, et cetera, et cetera. So the one grounds we're going to take is truth and say what we actually said is true, ergo it's not really libel. The second thing is we're going to do, and this is the real kicker, and I think this is important for your folks down there as well, is we're going to say, look, fair public comment is considered a libel defense. In other words, when a government is spending millions and millions and millions of taxpayer dollars on projects, it is completely fair and appropriate for the citizenry, i.e. me and my colleagues, to ask questions about where that money is going. And it's even better, it's a more needed discussion if that money is going overseas and it may be winding up in dodgy places. So that defense actually says, look, even if we're wrong, even if at the end of the day the money doesn't go to Hamas, it's still a fair question to ask, given that other governments are asking the same questions and that major international banks have already said they refuse to deal with these guys because they're terrorists. So this is part of what we want to do here in Canada. This is going to be a much larger discussion about the impact of foreign Islamist organizations coming to Canada, what they're doing. And we're seeing this discussion occurring in France right now with something called the Qatar Papers. We're seeing it in Germany. There's been a big kerfuffle in the United Kingdom where they just discovered umpteen billion dollars of British overseas charity money is winding up in one what politely called the wrong hands. And I think increasingly you're seeing this discussion in America as Linda Sarsour, Ilhan Omar, and a few others are becoming increasingly aggressive I think it's going to draw attention to all the organizations that support them in the background. So, yeah, I think it's actually a good thing. We may be getting to a point where we can actually have an open, honest, intelligent, calm discussion about what role foreign ideology should be allowed to play or should not be allowed to play in our respective society.
Well, it's interesting, Tom, that that has to happen in a courtroom. We, some of us in America, think that the legislators, our congressmen, are pretty much just looking for airtime on television. They push and shove. They try to make, but they really never do anything, and there really aren't indictments. So we've always been, that's why we're called Sharia Crime Stoppers. We believe there needs to be indictments, there need to be lawsuits, there need to be things where people are placed under oath and can be inquired by you know, lawyers, and but that's one way to have the story told. So one of my questions is, given a very slow pace in America for trials and lawsuits to proceed, is there a chance that there will be hearings and court proceedings during the election when this issue will be discussed, and you'll have an opportunity on with people under oath and discovery and so on and testimony and however cases proceed for the public to understand these issues, which are not really being covered by your legislators, at least your parliamentarians who are afraid to touch it? What's the timing on the case?
Okay.
Will it
so
be happening
there's
this
sort of
year?
Two answers to your, yeah. There's sort of two answers to your question. The first question is, will there be a open public trial proceeding before the federal election this fall? To the best of my knowledge, the answer to that question is no, there will not be. The pace at which these things move, as you say, is glacial. However, having said that, we are starting in the next few weeks. We are having our legal defense fund, which we've got on GoFundMe. So if folks want to look at it, if you go to GoFundMe and look at Operation Kill Switch, that's us. We want to get the news out there. We want to tell people this trial is going on. We will also be submitting a amended statement of defense in another period of time, like relatively short period of time. And in that statement of defense, we are going to add not just our legal statement of defense, i.e. truth and fair public comment, but we are going to look at a much larger body of information as to who's involved, what they've been doing, what organizations are involved, who they support, et cetera, et cetera. And here in Canada, the statement of claim made by Islamic Relief Canada against us is a public document. They can show that to people. They can post it on the internet. They can do whatever they want with it, and it's completely legal for them to do that. But the statement of defense put forward by ourselves, we can do the same thing. And the amended statement of defense, we can do the same thing. So we're hoping that with the election coming up this fall and with young Mr. Trudeau having put these kinds of issues into play, we think this is a excellent bit of timing for us. So short answer, no, there won't be a formal trial proceedings. Longer answer, we're going to get this onto the public radar in the summer moving into the fall election.
Excellent. Well, you've made a very good point there. The court of public opinion is particularly important this year leading up to the election. Can you mention again how people can find the GoFundMe account, please?
Yeah, it's we call it Operation Kill Switch. And the term actually comes kill switch. I mean, it's sort of a military term and a car racing term and a motorcycle term. But a kill switch is just something you hit to stop things happening. What we want to stop is this process of lawfare, where if anybody in Canada says anything or publishes anything that's critical of radical Islam, they wind up getting lawsuits against them. And there's all kinds of these things going on in Canada. So what we're saying is, look, we want to take this particular lawsuit and do two things with it. One, we want to demonstrate that the information the RCMP complaint is correct. The discussions we had with various media after that were correct, ergo they were not liable. But the second thing we want to do is expose this whole process of political correctness, lawfare, Islamophobia, whatever, and say, no, our greatest single freedom in the West, which comes to us from our Judeo-Christian values from Europe, et cetera, it's not the right to life. It's not anything else. It's freedom of speech. Because if you lose freedom of speech as a society, everything else follows. You lose it all later. So as much as people say, you know, the right to be alive is probably your greatest single human right, we would argue actually free speech is probably your greatest single human right as a group or as a nation. Because if you lose that, everything else is gone. So the Quiggin Report podcast we do is posited exactly on this issue of free speech. If you're going to have a democratic society, if you're going to have a just society, if you're going to have a society in which law and order and the Constitution are paramount and not someone else's religious values, you need to have those public discussions as to what is acceptable and what is not. And if you're allowed to criticize Christianity and you're allowed to criticize the Jews and the Hindus and everybody else, but you're not allowed to criticize extremist Islam, then you've got a problem. So we're sort of drawing a line in the sand here and saying it's almost time that we actually have a national discussion on this issue, and we're going to force it to happen.
Well, and as you know, we are focusing on Canada. Mary, go ahead. Liza Jane, please. Sorry.
Sorry. So, Tom, out of your lawsuit and when it finally gets settled, do you see this as a formation to possibly get something equivalent to the First Amendment so that Canada has the in their ruling, in their constitution, so that people like CARE don't come in with their lawfare and are able to push people around?
Yeah, we already have. I mean, we already have a constitution and a charter of rights that has very strong positions on these things. But like your First Amendment, it's only useful if it's enforced.
Right.
You know, you don't have a right to freedom of speech in America. You have a privilege. Because when you can be silenced with lawfare, when you can be harangued out of your job, I forget who it is, some campus police chief now has just lost his job because he liked a report about Donald Trump on Twitter. He didn't say anything. He just clicked the like button. And now he's lost his job because he's, you know, he doesn't constitute a safe space for the campus. So, you know, so much
here,
for freedom of speech.
Yes,
I didn't even say anything. I'll just look that up. He is a campus police chief in America, and his sin, such as it was that he liked a Trump thing, and I think it was on Twitter.
Oh, that's incredible.
That's
incredible.
Campus chief.
I'm guessing probably California or New York.
Here we go. Campus police chief put on leave after liking a Trump and an NRA tweet. So Mount Holyoke College announced this week that its newly selected campus police chief would be placed on administrative leave because he liked a Donald Trump tweet. So there you go. What about freedom of speech in America, where all he did was click a like button on Twitter, and it was a like button for the president of the United States? Now, you can choose to like or dislike Donald Trump. You know, that's up to you. If you don't like the guy, fine. But nonetheless, he's a sitting legal president of the United States, and simply clicking a like button for him was enough to have his job pulled. So freedom of speech in America is dead, folks. You can sit there and talk about First Amendment all you want, but if there aren't people out there to get behind it and actually enforce this kind of thing, then you're on an incredibly slippery slope, and I would say you're more than just on the edge of the slope, you're going down it.
That's kind of
an issue.
I would agree with a lot of what you said. It is dead, but we at least have the First Amendment so that we can go to court and go to battle and fight for what the amendment stands for and get legal representation to fight and make that, like you said, people need to fight for it and actually follow through with it.
That's the same thing we're doing here. We have a right to a freedom of communication, freedom of speech here, but it only works if you actually enforce it, if you actually go to court. And of course, these things are massively expensive. Either need corporate support or political support. And what we're choosing to do this time, rather than like we did last time and go through private supporters, we actually want to take this public. We want to get Canadians involved and Americans involved and say, hey, if you actually support free speech, send us $10, send us $100. Hey, if you're rich, send us $1,000. That's great. but we want people to send $10 is great, because we want people to get on the record as saying they support freedom of speech and they want to see these kinds of actions move ahead in the courts. So we want to make this very much a public case so people can see it. We want people to be involved in it. And we're kind of surprised. We were hoping to do okay. We were only about 2 weeks into it, and we've already raised about a third of our objective, and we're getting support everywhere from I think we've had people send us $5, which is great, and we've had people send us $300 and $500, which is, like, wonderful. So, it's been quite successful. So
that's good to hear.
And
hopefully it's a broad – broad donation in terms of Canada and the U.S. to help move that forward.
Yeah, because it's interesting. You talked earlier about how this is a sort of cross-border project and how the Muslim Brotherhood in particular, in their own documents, they literally view North America as a single unit. And just a couple of things popped to mind there we haven't talked about. One is something called the Islamic Circle of North America, which is quite active in the United States, here in Canada as well, but a lot in the United States. And they have a big Spanish language program going. They're pushing into California. They're pushing into Mexico. They're pushing into the Caribbean. And bizarrely enough, they're pushing into Venezuela and Colombia, of all places. I know a guy in Medellin who said he was in the town square a while ago, and there was a Viva Palestina demonstration, and he thought, like, Hamas? Like, what is Hamas doing in Venezuela? Sure enough, anyway, that's where it's going. So that's expanding right through North America, now into South and Central America. But when you talk about actual organizations with a cross-border capability, you've got the Islamic Society of North America in both Canada and the USA, the Muslim Student Association, Canada-USA, Palestine Committee in North America and Canada is in both. The Council for American Islamic Relations USA has a Canadian chapter called Council for American Islamic Relations Canada, now known as NCCM. Benevolence International was a big funder of Al-Qaeda back in the old days. Well, there was a Benevolence International Fund of Canada. ICNA that I just mentioned has offices here in Canada and the USA. We have something called Muslim Youth of Canada, and there's something called Muslim Youth of North America / USA. There's the FIC Council of North America, which has offices in both Canada and the USA. There's the North American Islamic Trust, which here in Canada is called the Canadian Islamic Trust. The Muslim World League used to operate in both countries. The Muslim American Society used to operate in both countries. And MEA, the Muslim Arab Youth Association, used to operate in both Canada and America. So as much as they have distinct organizations, i.e., you know, one in Canada, the Islamic Society of North America and Mississauga, the reality is many of them, in fact, have American partners or American franchises, I guess, if that's the right term.
That would imply the easy flow of information, of common sermons on Friday afternoon for imams that are connected. That would imply a network of mosques. That would imply the easy movement back and forth, not just of material, but of human beings. So the radicalization could take place in one side of the border and very easily get to the other side of the border with support locally, perhaps.
So, for instance, the ISNA in America has a big international conference, which they do once a year. There's always a bunch of Canadians at it. When they have the one up here, there's always a bunch of Americans show up. So, yeah, there's a cross-pollination, if you will, of belief systems, money, organization, and personnel.
And so one of, again, Philippe.
We have Kelsey, who is one of our Canadian listeners, and she was asking if you know anything about Joe Hazelton. I think he's one of the authors on some of the articles I was pulling up as well.
Yes, Joe Hazelton was not, quote, not an individual who helped write the report to the RCMP. However, Joe Hazelton is one of the people being sued along with me by Islamic Relief Canada because of a YouTube video that he and I made together talking about the report we'd sent to the RCMP. Yeah, Joe's what we would call a good old boy from down in Nova Scotia. Very well-read guy, very outward-looking, former Liberal Party of Canada member, very strong Liberal supporter. And then he started watching Justin Trudeau and said, wow, you know, there's some unusual things going on. And he sort of said, you know, I really just can't support the Liberal Party anymore if it's going to take on its kind of globalist, progressive, cultural Marxist, post-nationalist kind of theme, which it is. And particularly the reality is, I mean, Mr. Trudeau, our prime minister, has, as I mentioned earlier, sided with the Islamists on every single issue with one possible exception in the entire 11 years he's been member of parliament or prime minister. So yeah, Joe is one of my colleagues. I've done a couple of videos with him, and we communicate regularly.
Now, you mentioned something about a program that you have on a regular basis. Is that, where is that at, and how can people listen to your programs?
We have a program called The Quiggin Report. It's a podcast. It comes out on a fairly regular basis, once or twice a week, and it's available in all the usual suspect places, Patreon, Stitcher, SoundCloud, iTunes, and those sorts of places. We don't have a YouTube channel because we got banned by YouTube literally when we put out our first trailer. So before we even got started, we got banned by YouTube. And when we pushed them and said, like, we didn't even say anything, like, how can we be banned already? Apparently we triggered an algorithm down there or something like that. And we think what we did was we upset YouTube, and like we've upset many other political forces, because we put the term free speech, intelligence, national security, and terrorism in the same sentence. And that really triggers the likes of folks that run YouTube and others, because they are terrified of the whole idea of free speech and these kinds of discussions.
Oh, yeah, those are words you never put together, right?
Go
ahead.
Yeah, it's rather ironic, but well, there it is.
Well, we have our own little YouTube story that is percolating. We do a number of webinars, and for some reason, the folks at YouTube decided to put a warning message over our video and warning people that what they're about to see might be offending some, has been reported as offending some people. They can proceed at their own risk. Well, some people, when they see that, kind of that black warning sign, are deterred from proceeding, and so on. The question is, what did we do? And the interesting thing is the specific work that we did had to do with anti-Semitism and Islam. And so we're still pending that. We're appealing the move, but it's kind of a badge of honor, I guess. You've already earned that. I'm just curious. Can you? So if somebody Googles Quiggin, Quiggin podcast, they'll be able to find you. Is that fair?
Yeah. If you just type in like Quiggin Report, Quiggin Report,
yep.
You should find us on Stitcher, SoundCloud, Patreon, iTunes, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay, and wanted to repeat the book again, the availability of your book, please.
If you go on to Amazon.com, which is to say the American side, the book is Submission, The Danger of Political Islam to Canada with a Warning to America, written by yours truly, as well as another fellow named Tahir Gora, who's a Pakistani Muslim guy that lives here in Canada. Saeed Schwaib is an Egyptian Muslim guy who lives here in Canada. And then Jonathan Kotler and Rick Gill were two other folks who contributed to the book. So there's kind of a joke we sort of say, like, you know, three Muslims, a Jew, and a Christian wander into a bar, and they wrote a book. But anyway, so it's very much. And then the foreword was written by Rahil Reza, a woman in Toronto who's a Sunni Muslim, who is a huge advocate against the extremists and speaks out against them regularly. And
she's part of Clarion Project. I think
has done a couple of really good videos, which have been promoted through Clarion Project. Yes, she has.
Yep. Wow.
Yeah. So the folks at Amazon, we sort of wondered if Amazon would be a little upset with it. But to give Amazon some credit, which is, you know, unusual because a lot of folks don't like Amazon. But having said that, Amazon so far has, with only the rarest exceptions, allowed a number of books to be published on a wide range of topics. And I kind of salute Amazon in the sense they haven't hassled us on this. So that's quite good, I think. I've heard rumors that Amazon is starting to think about cracking down on this sort of stuff, which I think is bad. But so far they haven't. So that's a good thing. Unlike Twitter, unlike Facebook, unlike Instagram and a few others, where they, interesting enough, I mean, this is weird. I got banned by Twitter for a few days. Because I said that a Canadian charity is bringing a Saudi imam to Canada who advocates killing Shia Muslims, advocates killing Jews, and advocates killing Christians. And I got banned for bringing that up. Bizarrely enough, the Ikhwan, which is to say the Muslim Brotherhood, has a Twitter account with a blue check. And somehow
right.
that's allowed to stay there. And that one kind of frustrates me. If Twitter wants to put a very strong filter on their own system, and hey, it's their system, they can do it if they want. If they want to put a very strong filter on their system to take out work which they see to be politically contentious, I say, well, okay, you know, it's their system, maybe they've got the right to do that. But yet at the same time, they allow the Muslim Brotherhood, which is a listed
right.
terrorist group in a whole bunch of countries, is allowed to have a blue check Twitter account. And you're just kind of like, come on there, jacket Twitter, you know, let's go one way or let's go the other, but let's at least be consistent. Let's not be hypocritical. So that's kind of my complaint about a lot of this stuff. If you want to filter out the politics, well, you know, maybe you can, I don't know. But if you're going to do it to everyone.
Right. And we've got a good friend, Laura Loomer. I don't know if you've heard of her. She's a Jewish woman, young woman, activist, very much against what's going on with the Islamists and the Marxists in the U.S. government. And she's actually been in Canada a few times in some of the conferences trying to confront the likes of some of these Islamists. And she has been banned from Twitter, from Facebook, from PayPal, from numerous other ones, Lyft, Uber, all of them. And so she's got a lawsuit now that she's brought up, and she is going after all of them. She literally handcuffed herself to the Twitter front doors in New York City and said, why do you allow Nation of Islam and other Islamists to have a Twitter account, but you ban me for stating the facts? Just like you, Tom. It's like,
yeah.
If you're going to do it fairly. So it's going to be a lawsuit we're going to be following.
There is some movement afoot in California, in Silicon Valley, by some people to say that the tech industry kind of has to go one way or the other, but they got to make a decision and decide what are they doing. Are they providing a service, which is to say Twitter or Facebook, in which case you should be allowed to use the service to whatever way you want, or are they trying to be a political organization to promote some groups while strangling in others? In which case, okay, fine, but at least say you're doing that. So one of the possible answers to this, and this is being discussed in some areas, is to force companies like Twitter, to force companies like Facebook and Instagram, etc., to become what we legally call common carriers. So, for instance, Verizon or Bell or whoever, your phone provider, can't cut off your phone because they don't like what you say on the phone. They're there to provide a phone service. That's what they do. And of course, Verizon or Bell also can't get into trouble if I take my phone tonight and order somebody to kill somebody over a phone. It's not the fault of Bell that their phone was used to do that. So common carrier status would allow Twitter, Facebook, etc., to say, as long as you're not doing anything overtly illegal with the system, you're free to use it. So you couldn't use Twitter to actually order an assassination or to sell drugs to someone or something. But you would be able to have open political discussions in much the same way common carrier is actually sort of an airline term. United Airways or Southwest or Air Canada or British Airways or whatever can't refuse to sell you a ticket because you voted for Donald Trump. They are a common carrier. They have to accept everyone as a passenger, provided you're willing to pay for the ticket and provided, you know, you don't threaten the airline staff while you're on the airplane or something. So that's one of the things I know that's going on out there quietly. And the tech community itself is badly divided because they see what's going to happen. If they don't clean up their act, they're going to get legislated into something. And, of course, they want to avoid that. So common carrier status, if you're ever in discussions with politicians or if you're talking about Twitter or Facebook, tell them, that's the direction we need to go, is to make them common carriers so that they become a common platform for everyone to use with one set of rules for everybody.
Interesting concept, Mo. I'll turn it back over to you.
Well, I think we've covered a lot of territory, Tom, and we really are grateful for all of your time and all of your insight and all of your actions. You know, this is called the Sharia Crime Stoppers Action Line on purpose because we always like to talk about action that people can take as opposed to just becoming educated and going back to life as normal. Life is not normal. Some of us believe we're in World War III. Some of us believe that the election in Canada in 2019 and the election the United States in 2020 are important, potentially historic events. And so I think you've laid out a couple of action items. One of them, I'm sure that the GoFundMe for Operation Killswitch will accept American donations. That's correct, right, Tom?
Yes, GoFundMe is sort of a common platform, so you can use American dollars or Indian rupees or whatever. Yep.
So Americans, if they really are trying to think about things strategically, they may be really interested in putting somebody, a better person, on the city council where they live. That may be a good thing locally, but there are people who believe we're running out of time and that these two elections in 2019 and 2020 are pivotal. There are experts, ex-Muslims, we've had them on our show, specifically Sharam Hadian, who says that the upper house, that is the place where Sharia folks can be Sharia folks openly, they don't have to lie, they can, they're past accommodation, they're now in a power position. Places like France and even Norway are perceived to be in the upper house by international Islamists. So the notion here is that we're moving quickly to that position. Sharam's position is we're 2 to 5 years away from having parts of America, perhaps Michigan, Minnesota, but others defined to be in the upper house, which is a pretty much a point of no return historically. So with that in mind, go ahead.
I was going to say there's an interesting discussion to be had on the country of France, that it's kind of the one you might want to watch. France and Sweden are sort of the two big ones along with Belgium, because a number of people in France, including the former head of their internal intelligence service, actually said that France faces an internal civil war if they get a couple more bad terrorist attacks. Another thing that just happened in France that nobody noticed was the internal security minister quit. This is the guy that works for the current president, Macron. He is a longtime hardcore socialist, what we might call a bleeding heart liberal over here. And he quit Macron's government because Macron won't take a hard enough line on radical Islam in France. And that's like
when
a
did he quit?
French socialist.
When did he quit?
It's not like last fall sometime.
Oh, okay.
6 months ago, something like that. Yep. It got no play over here in North America at all. But yeah, it was quite stunning that a French left-wing socialist has criticized Macron in public, saying, you know, you either deal with this problem or we don't, but you've got to do something. And when he realized that Macron won't do anything, then he walked away. Just a little heads up for your listeners. If you go into Google News or just Google or, you know, DuckDuckGo or whatever system you want to use, type in the expression Qatar Papers, Q-A-T-A-R, a reference to the country of Qatar, and papers. And what it is there has been a massive document leak from the government of Qatar. The documents wound up in the hands of a couple of French journalists. And what the documents do is they outline the literally hundreds of millions of dollars Qatar has been putting into Europe, Canada, and America to advance Muslim Brotherhood mosques, schools, and cultural associations and politicians. The book is just out. Unfortunately, right now it's only in French, which means it's a little limited for some folks. They have a documentary coming out in June, which will be in English and French, so folks can watch it. But I have a copy of the Qatar Papers for Canada. Somebody in the Middle East, somebody I know who works in a low position somewhere, had access to these leaked documents and sent me the Canadian ones. And later this year, we'll be exposing how much money the country of Qatar has been spending in Canada to advance the cause of the Muslim Brotherhood. So, and I'm also telling you, there's a set of American papers out there as well, which will detail how many millions of dollars have been poured by the state of Qatar into America to announce or to enhance the Muslim Brotherhood's position in America. And I clearly won't say the term Brookings while we're talking about all this.
Right. We won't say. By the way, you are so versed in so many topics. The whole topic of Qatar is really interesting. I will give you a couple of quick coincidences. There's a movie out called, a documentary called Blood Money. We will be showing that on one of our webinars coming up. And it is a story, a part of the story, not the complete story you mentioned, but part of the story. It's about money coming into the United States. I will share with people, they can Google Stop Qatar Now, and they will find a series of reports from about 4 years ago that participated in. And it's unbelievable. If you look at Brookings, that's what Blood Money is about, as well as Blood Money. And these papers, I'm sure, talk about Brookings as a major receiver of funding from Qatar. But there's a lot more. Georgetown University has a campus in Qatar, and it is completely paid for. The operation of the Georgetown University campus is completely paid for by the government of Qatar. The Foreign Service, that's where Georgetown trains Foreign Service candidates. It is illegal to criticize the government of Qatar inside the state. So obviously the curriculum at the Georgetown University School for Foreign Service Workers is clearly one-sided. And you can go on and on. So this whole notion of Qatar is going to be a real scandal. There was some early work done a few years ago. We will look for the Qatar papers that you mentioned. That's a great comment and a whole program and research all by itself.
Yeah, it's thousands of documents. It's bank records. It's emails. Mm-hmm. It's letters of support for institutions in North America. And the letter of support comes from Yusuf Karadawi, who is the single most important cleric in the entire Muslim Brotherhood movement. And he's head of the International Union of Muslim Scholars. So when a guy like him endorses it, it's like, wow, that's serious. So, so your readers can just say, if you want to follow along with some of the stuff we do, you can look at the Quiggin Report. We talk about quite a bit of this stuff, how it applies to America, Canada, France, et cetera. Operation Killswitch, there's a good explanation there as to what's on the GoFundMe site, is what we're all about. And, yeah, keep an eye out just over the next several months for the Qatar papers or the Qatar papers. The scandal is just getting started in France now. The book came out in April in French. I suspect an English version will be out in a while. And it actually says that there are French politicians who've turned a blind eye to terrorism and extremism in France because of the money from Qatar.
Mm. Tom, we are good friends with quite a few different former CIA, former FBI, former Intel. What is going on in Canada? Is there a group of former Intel retired generals similar to you that are doing the same for Canada, or is it very limited in terms of who's speaking out about what's happening?
Yeah, interestingly enough, Canada doesn't really have a sort of think tank culture that y'all have in America. If you're interested in any given subject in America, you can bet there's a think tank in Washington looking at it, whether it's ex-CIA folks or pro-Qatar folks at Brookings or whatever. We don't really have that culture up here for reasons I've never clearly understood. And at the moment, we don't have kind of a coherent voice speaking on these kinds of issues. We do have Muslims Facing Tomorrow, which is a Shia and a Sunni Muslim group, which are starting to look at this kind of stuff. We have a few folks like myself and David Harries and a couple of others that are speaking out on it. We know that there is a lot of public support at the lower level for this kind of stuff based on like simple things. I'll put out a thing on Twitter about something going on here in Canada, and we'll get like 100,000 impressions on it very quickly. So we know there's a lot of Canadians who have a true interest in this subject, but we don't yet have that sort of coherent national voice that you all have down there.
Mm. You mentioned Twitter. What is your Twitter handle so people can stay in communication with you?
Oh, I've got sort of like two different ones going. One is just called Quiggin Report. At Quiggin Report, which is actually run by my producer, and that's kind of the official voice of the Quiggin Report on Twitter. And then the other one is my old Twitter account that I've been using for several years, which is just still there, and it's at Tom Tsek. So it would be like at TOMTSEC.
Well, we're going to be following
you. Well, I think we
could. We're going to be following you. Go ahead, Mo.
All right.
Well, Liza Jane, I think your questions and comments have been really important. And, of course, Tom, you've covered so much material here. This is really, really great. I think you've given a real gift to the American audience who's getting to know you. And the Canadians that already do know you, I'm sure, learned some things as well. We're going to continue to follow all of this. We're very interested in Canada. It's a major blow to America if Trudeau is elected in 2019. And as far as I can tell, you are the guy with your expertise, your background, your outbound material, and your court case in the public opinion, court of public opinion. You'll be really a major reason for people to pay attention. And hopefully you'll wake up a lot of Canadians, and Mr. Trudeau will leave office after the election.
Well, thanks very much for those kind comments, and thanks for the invite to your radio show. And perhaps later on in the year, once we get the amended statement of defense out, we can have another little discussion about where we're all going on these kinds of issues.
That would be great.
Okay.
That would be great.
All right, we're going to think about North America. We're going to play Proud to Be an American, but we're going to think North America. And again, thank you, Tom Quiggin, very much, everybody. Good night.
Cheers. Thanks very much.
If tomorrow all the things were gone, I'd work for all my life, and I had to start again with just my children and my wife, thank my lucky stars to be living here today. But the flag still stands for freedom, and they can't take that.